Hello and welcome to Rainer Hirsch's Problems in the Pub. My name is Rainer Hirsch. I am a conductor and comedian, and this is the podcast that sneaks a sideways, unofficial glimpse at the BBC Proms. Every year, the Proms marks the anniversaries of composers born or died some important number of years ago. One of the most significant of recent times, the 250th anniversary of the birth of Ludwig van Beethoven in 2020, was kiboshed by an uncooked bat in Wuhan, or wherever it was. The Chinese authorities are a bit tight-lipped about that, though I can't help feeling that if whoever ate the uncooked bat had been a bit more tight-lipped, we could have avoided a lot of trouble. Be that as it may, this year's Proms' celebrate ease include Dame Ethel Smythe, whose hits feature March of the Women, which actually received its very first performance at the Albert Hall in 1911. Then there is the 100th birthday of Greek composer Yanis Xenakis, an important name in music, especially if you're in a pub quiz and need to think of a composer for every letter of the alphabet. Then there is Ralph Rafe Vaughan Williams. This year is 150 since his birth. After years of Britain being referred to as das Land ohne Musik, the country without music, Rafe led the revival of British music in the 20th century, not least with his nine symphonies, including number 2, the London, number 3, the Pastoral, number 8, the Dentist, number 9, the Jehovah's Witness. Okay, I made those last two up, but not forgetting, and this is a real one. Number 1, A Sea Symphony. At the very toppest of Rafe's top hits is The Lark Ascending, a 15-minute piece for solo violin, usually accompanied by a string orchestra, the violin imitating the bird, and the orchestra representing a recently washed car underneath the bird. That can be heard on the 26th of August in Prom 52. After that, all the big Vaughan Williams box office is based on tunes he didn't actually write but kind of collected, along with people like Cecil Sharp, with whom Vaughan Williams had a running competition to see who could be most pastoral. This includes his Fantasia on Greensleeves, and a particular favourite of mine, if you hear the episode with Simon Townley, his Fantasia on a theme by Thomas Tallis. OK, so that's Rafe, and add to that this year, the Proms celebrating what it describes as Cinderella instruments. I'm not entirely sure where that term comes from, but it usually means anything that normally doesn't get an outing or which has to be put back in its case before it turns into a pumpkin. So basically, not the piano or violin. Cinderella instruments, according to the BBC website, include the French horn, the trombone, the harp, the viola, the flute, the percussion, even the entire splendid Tredegar Brass Band, whose concert I attended last Monday. Apart from their sound and virtuosity, I also sneakingly enjoyed their fantastic uniforms, which made them look a bit like Trumpton Fire Brigade in red. The Venn diagram union of those two concepts, anniversaries and Cinderella, gives Ethel Smythe's Concerto for Violin and Horn, which we heard on the 25th of July. You can catch it on BBC Sounds. Vaughan Williams' Tuba Concerto, which is happening on the 15th of August. And coming up this Sunday, the 11th of August at 11 a.m., the Vaughan Williams Oboe Concerto, which will be played by the wonderful Nick Daniel. British listeners may remember Nick from when he won the BBC Young Musician of the Year back in the year dot. I first met him when we performed together at a festival in Australia, but ran into him again in May, playing his beloved Vaughan Williams at De Montfort Hall in Leicester with the redoubtable Leicester Symphony Orchestra. After his performance backstage, to the accompaniment of a fridge and other noises off, we talked about Nick's story so far and his love of his own particular Cinderella. So, hey Nick, for a start.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
You too.
I really loved your performance of the Vaughan Williams Oboe Concerto.
Yeah, it's a wonderful piece. It's it's the piece with which I, or one of the pieces with which I won BBC Young Musician in 1980.
Did you do it then?
I did the first movement. Because the first movement sort of stands like a tone poem on its own, a bit like a Sibelius tone poem. And of course, this this concerto was written at the same time as the Fifth Symphony, which is dedicated to Sibelius.
Yes.
And so I think he had Swan of Tuonela in his mind. And, and so that first movement was very good. And I played it with the Marcello Concerto, but that's going back, you know, many, many years. But it's still very, very important to me. And I think it's somehow Vaughan Williams has gone in and out of fashion so many times that now he seems to be back in. And I'm so pleased because it's great to play this piece.
It's almost your signature piece because you did it first time. You did it at the Proms, didn't you? In fact, you gave... I think what is vaunted to some extent as the Proms premiere, the real London Proms premiere. Oh,
really?
Yeah.
What? Because it was done at the Albert Hall.
Because it was done at the Albert Hall, as opposed to Liverpool, which was where it was, you know, which were the first performed.
I remember the year before I played Bizet Symphony in C, and John Drummond came up and he said, "Well, I think you'd better come and play the Vaughan Williams next year. What do you think?" I said, "Yes, please."
Very nice. Let's go back to the beginning. You were at school in Salisbury or around there?
I was a chorister at Salisbury. Yeah. My parents lived in Hitchin, and I was a chorister at Hitchin Parish Church. I mean, it was just better than actually attending the church service as a person, which I would have been forced to do.
Yeah.
So actually singing just was much better fun. And then my voice kind of got good, actually. And then my mum was trying to keep up with her sister who'd sent her son to King's Cambridge as a choral scholar, as a choir boy and then a choral scholar. And in fact, my cousin Charles Daniels is a very well-known tenor. I'm Daniel, he's Daniels. I blame the parents.
No, don't.
But he's a wonderful, wonderful singer. But I took up the oboe to go to Salisbury because you had to play two instruments. So basically, My mum said, "Look, Nicky's got to play two instruments. What do you think he should play?" She said to her mum. My granny said, "The boy must play the oboe." And my mum said, "What the fuck's an oboe?" You may have to bleep that out.
No, this is our own podcast. We can
it's
say
absolutely
we
true
can say
what she said. And then I think, I don't know whether Emma Dale was going then, but I think it was something like, you know, we were able to make it work. Just hold on a second.
Yeah, that's that fridge. Yeah, unplug that. Is that fridge? Yeah, well done.
Yeah.
So you were...
So I took it up then, and I was
what was your first? Lucky. What was your first instrument?
Piano, which I took up when I was about six. My mum said, "Do you want to ride horses or have a piano lesson?" I know it sounds frightfully middle class, but actually, I suppose it was. But my dad was a prison officer, and my mum did old ladies' feet. But we lived in the country, and everybody could have, you know, there were lots of people having sort of horseback riding lessons. I was terrified of horses. I love them now. I don't ride, but I love horses. But
so there's no that your parents weren't musical.
Absolutely not a musical bone in their bodies.
Weird.
Nothing. Well, you know, you say weird, but actually, my grandfather apparently played the flute when he was young, and it's difficult to say because my mother's maiden name was Tomkins, and it could be that we're related to Thomas Tomkins, the composer. So there may be genetical musical things, but it's very hard to say. But I discovered that music does something to me, and it always has, it still does, and it just I feel it just so strongly, and it's sometimes it's a burden, but because it's so distracting. But I once got done on the M4 for doing 126 miles an hour listening to Delius Late Swallows. And I got banned by a judge.
You didn't present that in evidence then?
I did, actually.
Drunk on the music of Delius. here's the thing about the oboe, forgive me. I mean, because it's the Marcello, there's a few Albinonis, and then there's the Mozart concerto. And
I have a concerto repertoire of 150 pieces.
There we go.
Probably 50 of which I've commissioned myself.
Yeah.
And that process of commissioning new composers is absolutely central to what I do.
Yeah.
Next year, I'm not sure whether we're doing it at the Proms, but we're definitely going to do it in London. I'm commissioning a piece by Outi Tarkkainen, who's the most wonderful Finnish composer.
Right.
And she's writing a piece called Milky Ways.
Cool.
Which is all about the Milky Way,
right,
and also about breastfeeding and lactation, which is something she's very familiar with because she's got three little children, one of which recently set fire to their sauna.
This So she lives out in a place where in Finland, yes. Presumably, where they've got scope for a sauna.
Yes, they live in Rovaniemi, just north of the Arctic, or at the Arctic Circle point, and one of their children put a sort of plastic toilet brush into the sauna fire.
That's probably a typical problem that
causes. I think it's not actually.
Finnish people go, "What is the problem? It happens to me all the time, doesn't it?"
But so the process of commissioning pieces is something that I mean, it's so thrilling to do, and I'm so lucky to be able to do it still. And and the other day at the Wigmore Hall, I had a birthday concert, which was very kind of John Gilhooly, and I premiered 14 new pieces. Some of them were only 30 seconds long. Some of them were 12 minutes long.
Yeah.
But I had a whole series of birthday cards written for me by lots of different composers, including Elena Alberger, Erilyn Wallen, Hannah Kendall. Those are three very notable women, black women, who wrote for that concert. Hugh Watkins, Helen Grime, Colin and David Matthews. I mean, it was a wonderful, wonderful thing to do. But it's the reason they did that for me is because they feel safe giving me their music, putting it in my hands, because I will, with any music, I will always put the composer first. And I will always go from what the text says. And when you're working with a composer that's alive, that's a great benefit, because you don't have to be an archaeologist at all. When you're working on something like, I don't know, Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, there's an element of archaeology around about how the instrument sounded at that time, how how the scale of them in a way. And so with the trombone, which only appeared in the end of that piece, or the piccolo or something, what would it have sounded like in Beethoven's? Well, we don't know what Beethoven would have thought, because he was deaf anyway. So at that point, poor love. But it's just a fascinating thing to see how things put together. But giving with a composer there and you're giving their music, then you can ask them all those things, and there's a responsibility, but it's great.
Where does Vaughan Williams sit in that then? Where does he sit in the firmament of all the great oboe concertos?
Well, it's one of the very best. I mean, what's fascinating is that Vaughan Williams, a bit like Jan Arček, his hand is unbelievably messy. So he had a guy, I'm trying to remember the guy's surname, his name was Roy, but I met him a few times, and he would be the person who would say, "Now look, old boy, is this an F or an F sharp?" And he'd say, "I have no idea, old boy, what do you think?" He'd say, "Well, I think it's an F sharp." "Well, write that then." So he would basically be in charge of interpreting Vaughan Williams' hilariously messy manuscripts. And he would write them neatly, and then that's when they'd be given to the publisher. Of course, those manuscripts are now treasures in the British Library, treasured things. Janáček was the same. It was like making contemporary art. He would throw things on the page and then mess with them, and then sort of just, it was done. But I think that the Vaughan Williams Concerto is a wonderful piece because it is pictures of an older England, and yet at the same time, it has a sort of contemporary side to it, a sort of modern, urban side to it, which is sort of the last movement. The last movement's so clever because it's a bit like, you know, in a Mozart or Beethoven symphony or a Haydn symphony, you'd have a dance movement in three. And then you have a contrasting section, often slightly slower, and then you go back to the dance movement. Mm. Well, Vaughan Williams does that actually with two sections, which are metrically controlled to be twice as slow and then three times as slow. So he'll write that the two beat note equals the new single beat note. He writes it the wrong way around, actually. And then he writes that three beats become one beat. So when you're going da 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 da, so that's 1 2 3 1 2 3 1. It goes 1 2 3. So it's a very slow three. And inside is 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 1. And the first one that does that is going. Thank you. So, in fact, he slows it down with a very, very precise system that was actually used by Elliot Carter considerably and many more modern composers than Vaughan Williams. So it's fascinating that he did that so specifically. And so that last movement is very, as I say, very urban and very sort of, I mean, written right in the middle of the war as well. There's this golden moment in the middle of World War II in London when Howells wrote his oboe sonata and Vaughan Williams wrote his oboe concerto between 1942 and 45. And then there was a whole load of other composers, great composers who were also writing at the same time. And it's partly because of this man, Leon Goossens. When he, I mean, he was very, very, very famous as the first really famous oboist.
It was him that it was written for, that concerto.
Yes, it was. And actually, in my possession here in this room, I've got his oboe.
Does he know you've got it?
Well, unfortunately, the poor, he died some years ago, but his daughter knows I've got it. Right. She's lent it to me. I'm not going to play it in the promise, but I might play an encore on it, which is something I might well do.
That's special.
I think it would be very special. It's a very much simpler system instrument. But what's fascinating is that he was a legend at that time in World War II because he recorded the London Derriere. Yes. The Londonderry air, thank you, and on the coronet and oboe, the oboe, and actually it was at the top of what was called the hit parade for I think something like a year. It was a really, really big stint, and it made him money.
Times have changed, haven't
they? Yeah, times have changed, and it made him money, and it made people nostalgic and think of, you know, what they were missing. We didn't live through World War II, but we did live through a pandemic. So we know about nostalgia and what that means. I mean, the first time I heard listen to music during that period was to do a radio programme. And I listened to the Janáček concertino and I just started sobbing. I don't know why, just so open and amazing. But yeah, so Goossens was very inspirational. He was very famous, so they wanted to write for him. And Vaughan Williams did. As you've mentioned before, the world premiere was actually cancelled because the concert hall at the top of Regent Street near the BBC was destroyed overnight in an air raid, which is sad. It's never been rebuilt, but it hasn't. So it was then performed in Liverpool, which was Goossens' hometown. Because his famous musical family, his brother Eugene was a great conductor and a principal conductor of the Cincinnati and Sydney Symphony Orchestras, and also famously chose the design for Sydney Opera House. He was on that committee.
Right.
Yeah.
Was he a scouser then? Did he speak with a sort of Eugene Goossens?
Wasn't Keith.
He was the poshest man in the show.
Well, I think he was very posh, yes. I mean, I've heard a few recordings of him speaking, "Everything ends with old boy." apparently he used to swoosh around in a cloak as well. Somebody told me he wore a cloak.
Cloak's gone out of fashion. They're the rooms that you put them in.
I might bring them back in.
Now, tell us about actually playing the proms, because you've done it like more times than you can wave a stick. And the first one was with the Vaughan Williams Concerto,
yes,
in 1990. Does it ever get routine?
No. No, it's a big thing, and you have to be really ready. I mean, these days also there's telly and there's always live radio. So, it's one of those things that the excitement of it is great before, but nothing can prepare you for the feeling of walking out and the wave of sound from the audience that just embraces you. And because that audience really knows their onions, they know exactly who you are, and they're waiting for you to play, and they're waiting to welcome you to their arena. So it feels like it's an absolutely extraordinary thing to try to fill the Albert Hall, because it's like, I don't know how many thousand people it is, many. And the thing is, if you push the sound, you'll immediately not be heard. I discovered the way to be heard in there is to imagine that the sound is coming out of your back, bouncing off the back wall where the organ is, and then going forwards. So in order to be heard there as an oboist, I find there are tricks you have to have. And I think a great singer probably would do the same kind of thing. Imagine the sound in the back, in the middle back, then going backwards, then going forwards. So if you press, you'll make the wrong sound. And also you've got to remember there's many, many more times than that number of people listening at home with a microphone, which is quite close to you. Mm. So if you play, it's a very strange conundrum because you've got to be heard in the hall, but if you press, all the people at home will hear the wrong sound. They'll hear a slightly more edgy, more forced sound. Mm. So you've got to find a way of playing for both. But if you don't play in a way that touches the audience in terms of them hearing it properly, they won't lift you to the rafters, which is what the great thing that they do. So it is full of strange kind of contradictions, but at the same time it's so beautiful, the hall. It's so lush and opulent, and even though the shape is acoustically disastrous, actually they've done their best to make it acoustically work. But I think the thing that we all look forward to when you step on that stage is actually just that feeling of being lifted off your feet by the audience, which is unique. It is a unique audience. Some people say, well, where do they go after the proms? And I think they probably just, they go to lots of different places all over the country, maybe across the world. But for that time, and I think this time coming back with a full audience again is going to be absolutely amazing. I'm so looking forward to it.
You know, there are some comedy clubs that people like me struggle to slither up the greasy pole to perform at. The Comedy Store is one, where people traditionally underperform because they're so spooked by finally getting there. Is there any part of the proms which is like that?
No, because it's all done with it's done with a deep love of music. So that's that sense of it being about you is not really an important part of classical. It's an important part of a certain area in classical music, which is a more sort of personality-led thing. And I'm not stupid enough to think that personality isn't a part of my being successful. But actually, it's not a part of my performing. I want to allow the music to come through, and if it happens to come through cleanly and well, it's a bit like mediumship. That's how I think about it. But of course, if you're performing your own material, it's your material, it's got to be funny. And that's a bit like being a composer. I think being a composer and having a piece like the Proms must be absolutely hair-raising. Particularly one of those tiny ones that starts and ends the first night. Imagine, I know that also, I think Harry Burtless was probably pretty traumatised by the reception for Panic. Well, I don't know whether he was. He probably wasn't traumatised by anything much, but certainly his publishers were. But I think that, no, I don't think it's like that. There's an incredible sense of support backstage from the staff. And also, because I've never been sort of exclusively sort of against the orchestra kind of artist. There are artists that sort of, have in their rider, nobody must talk to me, nobody must breathe on me. I must be brought in an oxygen tank and then it opened before the rehearsal. And so, no, of course, the thing is the nerves are unusual because you've got to present yourself in a way that looks good to that many people. You've got to decide what to wear. You've got to decide all that stuff. But, I'm really looking forward to it because I think I know just about how to do it now there. And the thing is that I know that what happens is you get lifted by that and also by the listening quality of that audience. If you're standing up, and there's probably 1,000, maybe 700 people standing up in front of you, of course you're going to listen because you can't fall asleep.
Right, yeah. Yes, so what are you going to wear?
I don't know yet.
Can I just say, what you're wearing now is a rather splendid, and I didn't realise it being on the stage, but Ukrainian flag coloured shirt. Was that intended?
Yes.
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is, because I've also got this little knitted badge.
Yeah, I see.
Which has been done by a young Ukrainian girl who's recently moved to been displaced from Ukraine and come to Bedford.
Yeah.
And she's knitted those. I think there isn't a note I play, there isn't a a concert I give right now that doesn't have my Ukrainian friends somewhere, you know, either at the front or in deep inside my mind. It's unthinkable that we live at a time when that's happening in basically in Europe. And because my husband is Polish, I'm more involved in the whole discussion about it, because you get very different news in Poland than you do in the UK. I don't know why the news is so over-controlled here. I might have a theory about
it. It's funny though, because I know that we share something in common, which is German citizenship, don't we?
Yes.
We do. You hold a professorship in Trongenheim. Where is it?
It's in Trossingen.
Trossingen!
Which is in the Schwarzwald.
In the Schwarzwald.
Tief Schwarzwald.
Down there.
The hohe Plateau in Schwarzwald.
Now, this was formerly the music school at
Stuttgart. They moved it in the Second World War to save the lives of the students. And then, actually, the locals love having a music school there so much that they refused to allow it to go back, so they had to open a new school. So now Baden-Württemberg, which is the size of probably Hampshire, has 5 music schools the size of the Royal College of Music.
Yeah. It's amazing. I mean, it's basically amazing that the arts are so much better supported there. And there are these kind of professorships and stuff out there, which are then they're well paid.
Yes, it's very well paid. That's not the main reason for doing it. There's also a pension thing, which it was impossible to get with teaching at a music school over here in general. But that's not it. It's more the fact that it's my way or the highway with my class. I can choose exactly who I teach. If they audition, I can choose them or not. I have my own room. I have my own studio. She's got my recordings, my equipment. They bought me a piano. I mean, the facilities are astonishing. So there's a sense that if you really do know what you're talking about and you can really build a class, then there's a respect for that. I mean, I'm reliably told that my position in Germany is higher than a high court judge, because I have a senior civil service position, and I had to do a Schwörung.
Ooh, a swearing in.
Yes, and I had to read it, and I thought they were joking, and I thought it was candid camera. So I had to hold the piece of paper, and I had to mit Rechtshand auf, with my right hand up.
Yeah.
I said, do you mean with my right hand up? He said, yeah. The trouble was, it was only one person, and he looked scarily like Norman Bates, and he kept talking about his old mother running a bed and breakfast and everything, and I thought, hang on a minute, this cannot be right. So, ish, and then it said dot, 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 and I said, dot, 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 Nicolas Daniel. Ish Nicolas Daniel, my German was awful at this point. Schwöre das ich. And then it was a blah, 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 blah. I was torturing the German. And I just thought it was a joke. But no, it's incredibly serious, actual swearing. And then it said at the end, so hilfe mir Gott. And I said, oh, wait, is that God? I said, yeah. And I said, well, I'm not sure I can say that, really, because I don't know what I think about God. I haven't really made any decisions about that yet. And he said, Professor Daniel, Sie sind Beamter, which means you are now actually as an tenured civil servant inside the system, and I would have to murder somebody to be sacked.
Well,
so it's like the American version of tenure.
Yeah, no, because I know that whole thing about, you know, how well supported they are, the pensions, all that kind of stuff. It's I think a lot of people, especially during lockdown, were thinking, I need to get what Nick Daniel's got.
Easier said than done, particularly after Brexit.
Well, you have to be brilliant, like you are, and that's, and in fact, you are brilliant, and and I'm super looking forward to the concert. I have to say, I did, while I was thinking about chatting to you, happened to come across a website ranking the world's great oboists.
Oh yeah, I'm not very high, am I?
You're 12.
Shit. Well, I think the people who've got time to do that kind of nonsense, I mean, yeah, whatever.
They don't know nothing. I didn't recognise the first 11, basically.
Neither do I. They're all nobodies. No, I think those sort of things, you can drive yourself mad with that nonsense. But I would like to think that there is a legacy of new music for me to pass on to my great students in the future. I mean, it's hundreds of pieces. Like Evelyn Glennie, I stopped counting. Actually, I've got a rather funny Evelyn Glennie story about the proms.
So yeah, please.
We did a double concerto, which was written for...